KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Where are you now?
This is North Gaza. This is my neighborhood. No one lives here or here or there or there. There's no one.
Fatma Hassona, a 25-year-old Palestinian photojournalist, was killed with 10 members of her family in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza Thursday. She's the subject of a new documentary just accepted by the Cannes Film Festival. It's called Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. We'll speak with the film's director, Sepideh Farsi. But first, HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues his mixed messages on vaccines as the measles epidemic surpasses 700 cases in the United States with three deaths. We'll talk to vaccine expert Dr. Peter Hotez, author of Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad.
Our vaccine ecosystem is very fragile because measles is so highly transmissible. The minute you stop vaccinating and maintaining that vigilance of 90-95% vaccine coverage, measles comes roaring back, and that's what's happened here in West Texas.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Yemen, Houthi-run media reports U.S. airstrikes targeting the Ras Issa oil port have killed at least 58 people. Over 125 others were wounded. The U.S. has been systematically attacking Yemen over the past month after Houthi fighters vowed to continue targeting Red Sea ships tied to Israel's war on Gaza. U.S. airstrikes on Yemen have killed over 180 people since mid-March, including many women and children. Israel's bombardment of Gaza continues, claiming at least another 34 victims today, including 10 members of the same family that were killed in a strike on a home in Khan Yunis earlier today. Meanwhile, one of the victims of an Israeli airstrike on Wednesday was revealed to be the young Palestinian photojournalist Fatma Hassona. She was killed along with 10 members of her family in Gaza City. She's the subject of a new documentary that was just accepted at the Cannes Film Festival. We'll speak with the director, Sepideh Farsi, later in the broadcast. Hamas is calling for comprehensive ceasefire negotiations to definitively end the war on Gaza, including a full captive swap, as it rejected an Israeli interim proposal.
Netanyahu and his government use partial agreements as a cover for their political agenda, which is based on continuing the war of extermination and starvation. Even if the price is sacrificing all his hostages, we will not be part of passing this policy.
In legal news, the International Criminal Courts initiated proceedings against Hungary after the government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban failed to execute an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he visited Hungary earlier this month. Just ahead of the visit, Orban announced he's withdrawing from the ICC. Netanyahu is wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen confirmed Thursday night he met with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who the Trump administration says they forcibly transferred to an El Salvador mega prison last month by administrative error. Van Hollen shared a photo of the two seated together at a table in what appears to be a hotel restaurant. Senator Van Hollen traveled to El Salvador Wednesday in a push for Abrego Garcia's release, but had initially been barred from having any contact with him. Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer, celebrated the meeting, saying in a statement, "My children and my prayers have been answered," unquote. Meanwhile, in response to the senator's visit, Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele said on social media, quote, now that he's been confirmed healthy, he gets the honor of staying in El Salvador's custody. Bukele also wrote, quote, Kilmar Abrego Garcia miraculously risen from the death camps and torture, now sipping margaritas with Senator Van Hollen in the tropical paradise of El Salvador, unquote. Abrego Garcia lived in Maryland for almost 15 years after fleeing gang violence in El Salvador and is a sheet metal worker. This comes at a federal appeals court ruled the Trump administration must comply with a judge's order for government officials to be deposed over Kilmar Abrego Garcia's case. That judge, Paula Zinnes, is weighing contempt proceedings against Trump officials. In the unanimous ruling Thursday, Fourth Circuit Court Judge Harvey Wilkinson, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, wrote the Trump administration's acts are shocking, writing, quote, the government is asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process that is the foundation of our constitutional order, unquote. This all comes as ACLU immigration attorney Lee Gelernt has confirmed that a group of Venezuelan immigrants currently jailed at the Bluebonnet ICE jail in Texas were told they are at risk of also being expelled from the United States under the controversial Alien Enemies Act of 1798, despite the ongoing legal challenges against its use. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear oral arguments over President Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship. As the measure remains on hold, the hearing is scheduled for May 15th, with a decision likely to be issued this summer. Several federal lower court judges have blocked the order, saying it violates the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. Trump signed the executive order on his first day back in office. In other immigration news, Reuters is reporting Secretary of State Marco Rubio is ordering officials to review the social media accounts of visa applicants who visited the Gaza Strip any time in the past 18 years, including for work with aid organizations. A U.S.-born citizen who was arrested in Florida, accused of being undocumented and entering the state unlawfully, has been released after spending the night in jail on a 48-hour hold requested by ICE. Juan Carlos Lopez Gomez is from Georgia and was driving across state lines to his construction job in Tallahassee when he was pulled over, then taken into custody. He remained jailed despite presenting a copy of his birth certificate and Social Security card brought to court by his mother. Lopez Gomez was arrested and charged under a contested anti-immigration law known as SB4C, signed by Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis 2 months ago, despite a federal court order temporarily blocking the measure from being enforced. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has signed a $30 million deal with a controversial surveillance tech giant Palantir, which will be used to help track and deport immigrants, including people who might have overstayed their visas. A database would also track cases of self-deportation and share data with Customs and Border Protection. The outlet 404 Media reports Palantir, which was founded by Elon Musk ally and billionaire Trump supporter Peter Thiel, has been working in recent weeks to increase ICE's capacity to monitor immigrants with final deportation orders. The new agreement is an extension of a contract with Palantir first signed by the Biden administration. Here in New York City, members of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, their allies and elected leaders, gathered Thursday for the group's annual Seder in the Streets on the sixth night of Passover. The protest took place under the banner of No Fascists, No Pharaohs. New York City mayoral candidate Sohrab Mamdani, who's been endorsed by Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, spoke at the event.
And we know that in this moment in this city, when one in four New Yorkers is living in poverty, when 500,000 children go to sleep hungry every night, when more than 90% of New Yorkers agree that affordability is a serious issue, that this freedom is not just the right to live with our families in homes, but to be able to afford that home, to afford that dinner that we can share together as we break that bread.
Meanwhile, in Boston, 400 Jewish residents and others joined rabbis and community leaders to call for the release of the abducted Tufts graduate student, Ramesa Ozturk. The Passover rally was organized by the progressive Jewish group, If Not Now. On Wednesday, an immigration judge denied bond for Ozturk, declaring her to be a potential so-called danger to the community. Ramesa Ozturk is from Turkey. She was arrested in the streets of Somerville by masked agents for co-authoring a student op-ed on Tufts response to Gaza solidarity protests on campus. The Trump administration is threatening to bar Harvard from enrolling international students unless university officials hand over the records of its current international students. This comes after Harvard openly rejected Trump's earlier ultimatum to the school, asserting its independence and constitutional rights. Meanwhile, House Republicans launched a civil rights probe into Harvard over its policy on trans athletes and diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, which defy Trump's orders. On Thursday, protests took place on college campuses across the United States, condemning the White House's attack on education and students. This is a student at the University of California, Berkeley.
I think that we have something that we're fighting for that is a little bit different than what we've been fighting for in the past, and that is our very right to keep fighting and our right to resist and our right to speak and learn and teach, even if it disagrees with the current political regime. And I think this is the fight to win all fights, and that we need to show up and in a way that is more powerful and more abundant than in the past.
A federal judge ruled Google has run illegal monopolies on two markets for web advertising technology. It's the second antitrust ruling against Google in the past year. In 2023, a federal jury also concluded Google's proprietary app store is an unlawful monopoly. But the judge Thursday struck down one of the Justice Department's arguments against Google, making it unclear whether or when Google will be forced to sell off part of its online ad business. Consumer advocates welcomed yesterday's news, with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren declaring, quote, Google is an illegal monopolist and it's time to break up this tech giant, Senator Warren said. President Trump threatened to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell after Powell opted not to cut interest rates and warned Trump's tariffs are highly likely to raise inflation and slow growth. Trump made the comments, renewing an ongoing dispute in his first term, despite the Fed's independence being protected by law.
Oh, he'll leave. If I ask him to, he'll be out of there. But I don't think he's doing the job. He's too late, always too late, a little slow, and I'm not happy with him. I let him know it, and if I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
The Supreme Court is currently reviewing a case involving two labor officials whom Trump fired, but were later reinstated after judges determined the president does not have the authority to remove them. An outcome favorable to Trump in that case could pave the way for him to also fire Jerome Powell. The Trump administration is seeking to redefine the meaning of harm under the Endangered Species Act in a move which environmentalists warn would threaten the survival of hundreds of plant and animal species. The proposed rule would allow industry to degrade or destroy habitats of endangered species, including panthers, sea turtles, bald eagles, spotted owls, gray wolves, and humpback whales. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the United States will determine in the coming days whether ending Russia's war on Ukraine is doable and may soon withdraw U.S. involvement.
We need to figure out here now within a matter of days whether this is doable in the short term, because if it's not, then I think we're just going to move on from our perspective.
The comments reflect the tensions between Washington and Kyiv and the growing wedge between Trump and its European counterparts as they try to compensate for the change in U.S. involvement in the Ukraine war under Trump. Meanwhile, Trump said on Thursday his administration would sign a deal with Kyiv in 1 week, exchanging security for access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. The details of the deal are said to still be under negotiation. Inside Ukraine, Russian air attacks earlier today killed one person in Sumy and another in Kharkiv. The heavy bombardment in a residential area of Kharkiv wounded dozens of others, including children. In Florida, a 20-year-old son of a sheriff's deputy killed two people and injured at least six others when he opened fire Thursday on the Florida State University campus. Phoenix Ickner used a gun that was the former service weapon of Leon County Sheriff's Deputy Jessica Ickner, his mother. The suspect was also a member of the sheriff's youth advisory council. A motive has yet to be disclosed. And here in New York, a federal grand jury indicted Luigi Mangione, charging him with stalking and murder through the use of a firearm in the December shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. The murder charge holds a possible death penalty sentence if convicted. Mangione's lawyer accused Attorney General Pam Bondi of prejudicing the grand jury when she signaled recently she would seek the death penalty for Mangione. His defense said, quote, the stakes could not be higher. The United States government intends to kill Mr. Mangione as a political stunt, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues his mixed messages on vaccines as the measles epidemic spreads across 24 states in the United States. We'll speak with vaccine expert and autism dad, Dr. Peter Hotez. Stay with us.
صار الغريب يلتجي من باب لباب أمسى المساء يا غريب وتفتحت الجراح يا عين لا تدمعي جفاني وراح سافر وخدني معاك بفطر على دقاك بصبر على الجوع ما بصبر على الفراق.
The Night Has Fallen Down by Rimbana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In his first news conference as Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the vaccine skeptic who now oversees the nation's federal health agencies, focused on new findings about autism published in a Center for Disease Control report, which found an increase in apparent autism rates among 8-year-old children. Kennedy described autism as an epidemic and blamed environmental factors for the increase in the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder.
This is a preventable disease. We know it's an environmental exposure. It has to be. Genes do not cause epidemics. They can provide a vulnerability. You need an environmental toxin.
RFK Jr. did not connect autism to vaccines during his news conference, but in his previous role as chair of Children's Health Defense, he'd repeatedly claimed that vaccines cause autism, which they do not. Meanwhile, as the number of measles cases in the United States surpasses 700, RFK Jr.'s position on the measles vaccine is mixed. At an event Tuesday with Republican Indiana Governor Mike Brown and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz, Kennedy said the measles vaccine is leaky, which medical experts dispute.
People get measles because they don't vaccinate. They get measles because the vaccine wanes. The vaccines wane about 4.8% per year. And so, you know, that it's a leaky vaccine, and that problem is always going to be around.
Measles cases have been reported in at least 24 states, with the majority of infections in Texas, where the outbreak began in January. Three unvaccinated people have died from measles-related illnesses so far, an adult in New Mexico, and two elementary-age school children in rural Texas. Before that, there wasn't a measles death for the last decade. Earlier this month, Kennedy attended the funeral of the second child who died of measles, an 8-year-old girl in West Texas. During his visit, he posted on social media the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles is the MMR vaccine, unquote. However, he's also continued to raise safety concerns about vaccines. In an interview last week with CBS News chief medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook, Kennedy claimed the vaccines were, quote, not safety tested.
I'm not going to take people's vaccines away from them. Right. What I'm going to do is make sure that we have good science so that people can make an informed choice. And we are doing that science today so that we know the risks of that product, and we also know what the benefits are. And right now, we don't know the risks of many of these products because they're not safety tested.
And I understand that position, but just to be clear, you are saying, and we do on the federal level, and you personally do recommend that people get the measles vaccine.
Yeah, and when I say they're not safety tested, what I mean is they're not adequately. Many of the vaccines are tested for only 3 or 4 days with no placebo group.
Measles is a highly contagious airborne disease that's preventable through vaccines and had been considered eliminated from the United States in 2000. The disease has now spread to border communities in Canada and Mexico, with Canada reporting 730 cases, Mexico at least 360 cases with one death. For more on RFK Jr. and his positions on measles and autism and what to do about the growing number of cases of measles, we're joined now from Boston by Dr. Peter Hotez, who's usually in Texas. He's dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine, where he's also the co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. He's the author of several books, including The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning, and Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. Dr. Hotez, welcome back to Democracy Now! So
thanks for having me, Amy.
We recently spoke, but since then, I believe two more people have died of measles. If you can explain how rare this is and what actually is happening in your state of Texas.
Yeah, Amy, we haven't seen a measles death in a very long time. And now we have two unvaccinated children who tragically died from measles. These were otherwise healthy school-age children who did not have to die, but they weren't vaccinated with the highly effective and safe MMR vaccine. And this measles epidemic is really escalating. We now have at least 500 plus known cases of measles in West Texas. It's probably much higher than that, because if you do the back of the envelope calculation based on the case fatality rate of measles, there's probably closer to 1,000 or maybe even more than that cases in West Texas. And now it's extending into New Mexico, into Oklahoma, into Kansas. They all seem to be related to the same very large epidemic. So this is sweeping across the Great Plains. And we've had sustained transmission now since the very beginning of the year, possibly even earlier than that. And the worry is that we're going to reach a point where, if it continues, we could even lose our elimination status for measles, which was so hard fought.
Can you respond to RFK Jr.'s, what seems to be, I mean, it's nuance, but a slightly shifting position? He would not have endorsed MMR, the measles vaccine, before. But now, under enormous pressure, with hundreds and hundreds of cases of measles and it being fast growing, he has said he's not opposed to them. Can you explain and also address his concerns?
Well, his comments are insufficient. He grudgingly acknowledges the importance of the MMR vaccine and immunizations when it's the only way we're going to be able to contain this highly dangerous and lethal epidemic. So he needs to be much more of an advocate for MMR vaccinations. And he surrounds it with disinformation, Amy. You know, he says the measles vaccine is a leaky vaccine. I'm not even sure I know what that means, but it's absolute nonsense. It's one of the most effective and safest vaccines we have. A single dose, over 90% protection. Two doses, 97% protection. You know, I'm a vaccine developer, a vaccine scientist. We make vaccines for global health. We've reached 100 million doses of our low-cost vaccines for COVID administered globally, and now vaccines for parasitic disease vaccines. When we're designing our vaccine, our strategy, when we whiteboard this out, our gold standard is the MMR vaccine. We aspire to make a vaccine that's as good as the MMR vaccine, and yet he calls it leaky, which is absolute nonsense. He also gives an absolutely false number. He says there's a decline of 4% protection, vaccine protection per year. It's absolute nonsense. It's nothing like that. If it declines at all, and there's some estimates that it could be 0.04%, not 4%, so 100-fold less. So that's really unfortunate. And then when he talks about vaccination, he then often will pair it with this false equivalency, talking about a steroid, budesonide, which has no preventative activity, or vitamin A, which is not preventative, or he's using other unproven interventions. And that really sends a mixed message, because it tells parents, hey, you have the choice. Either you get the MMR vaccine or you get this nonsense cocktail of interventions. So he still has a long way to go about all of these things.
So let me go to RFK Jr. speaking to Fox News' Sean Hannity last month.
It used to be when I were kids, everybody got measles. And the measles gave you lifetime protection against measles infection. The vaccine doesn't do that. The vaccine is effective for some people for life, but many people, it wanes.
If you can respond, Dr. Peter Hotez, everyone used to get measles, he said.
That's right. Everyone used to get measles, and measles at one time was the single leading killer of children globally. And it caused hundreds of deaths annually in the United States in the pre-vaccine era. I mean, we've got, you know, we know what measles does. 20% of children who are unfortunate enough to get measles because they've not been vaccinated, 20% are hospitalized, measles pneumonia, measles encephalitis, permanent hearing loss from neurologic damage, sometimes loss of vision. Measles is a bad actor. It's one of the most serious childhood infections we know about. And the fact that he would be so dismissive of it, again, this is, had been consistently his modus operandi and the modus operandi of the anti-vaccine lobby. What they do is they're dismissive of the severity of childhood infections, especially measles. And what they'll do is they'll exaggerate the very, very rare side effects that occasionally occur, but we're talking extremely rare instances. And the consequence of that is parents then make executive decisions based on the disinformation coming from Mr. Kennedy and others and decide not to vaccinate their kids. And this is happening now across the Great Plains in the United States, and we see what the consequences are. Likely thousands of cases of measles, 56 hospitalizations so far, and now three measles deaths.
In March, the Washington Post reported that HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, hired David Geyer to study vaccine autism data. Geyer. Who is he?
I don't know much about him. That's a sort of a blast from the past. I hadn't heard his name or his father's name for some time. But the point is, you know, what's his rationale for doing this? There we have, as I've outlined in the book about my daughter, we have detailed evidence showing there's no vaccine and autism link. And one of the things the anti-vaccine lobby does is they always move the goalposts. As soon as the scientific community debunks one of their assertions, beginning with the MMR vaccine, then they come up with something else. So it was in the late 1990s, there was a false assertion or a fraudulent paper written claiming that the MMR vaccine causes autism. That was shown to be, that paper was retracted, and the scientific community followed with large cohort studies of hundreds or even thousands of kids, showing that kids who get the MMR vaccine are no more likely to get autism than kids who don't. And then a few years later, Mr. Kennedy in 2005 wrote an article in Rolling Stone magazine claiming, okay, if it's not MMR, it must be thimerosal preservative that used to be in vaccines. Similarly debunked with large cohort studies, even non-human primate studies. The scientific community was very vigilant in following up with his assertions. Then he switched it up again, or they switched it up again, saying it's because we're overwhelming the immune system by spacing vaccines too close together. Absolute nonsense. Then it was Alamin vaccines. So you're always kind of playing this kind of Pyrrhic game of whack-a-mole or moving the goalposts. But the other really important point, and the reason I wrote the book, Amy, was in response to a year of discussions I've had with Mr. Kennedy, you know, going through all of this, we have at least 100 autism genes that have been identified, many here in Boston at the Broad Institute at Harvard MIT. We did genomic sequencing on Rachel and my wife Ann, and I found Rachel's autism genes. And they all operate in early fetal brain development, very early on in pregnancy. That's when autism occurs. This is a genetic process. And yet he dismisses all of the massive scientific evidence, the fact that all of this is occurring in pregnancy. And by the way, I even had discussions with him saying, yes, there could be some environmental exposures, but not vaccines. These are environmental exposures that are occurring early on in pregnancy. Let me give you an example. If you're pregnant, and maybe don't realize it, and you're on an anti-seizure medication called Depakote, also known as valproic acid, you have a much higher likelihood of giving birth to a child with an autism phenotype. And there's at least half a dozen chemical exposures that I shared with Mr. Kennedy to look into this, but it's all occurring during pregnancy. And I was very puzzled by his lack of interest in it. I even said, you know, Bobby, I was calling him Bobby then, and I said, you should be all over this. You're an environmental attorney. This is your sweet spot. This is your moment to really look into this. This was 8 years ago. And he had no interest in it. He had this kind of fixed belief about vaccines when there was not only was there massive evidence showing there's no link, but the lack of plausibility, Amy. I think that's what's the most important part, is this is all occurring in early fetal brain development.
So what do you make of Bobby Kennedy saying that he will discover the cause of autism by September?
Yeah, that one's a head scratcher, because first of all, there's at least 100 autism genes. There are many different forms of autism, and it's not a simple cause, right? It's clearly the genetic component is huge. There could be some environmental exposures early on in pregnancy. That would all be very reasonable for him to look at, but the way he frames it is almost childlike. It's very simplistic, saying he's going to find the cause. Well, there is not a cause. It is a complex set of interactions between genes and the environment, very much like cancer. It's almost like saying that he's going to find the cause of cancer by September. It makes no sense on scientific grounds, and that's been explained to him in detail.
Let me go to the Health and Human Services Secretary, Bobby Kennedy, speaking at a news conference Wednesday morning.
Autism destroys families. More importantly, it destroys our greatest resource, which are our children. These are children who should not be suffering like this. These are kids who, many of them, were fully functional and regressed because of some environmental exposure into autism when they're 2 years old. And these are kids who will never pay taxes, they'll never hold a job, they'll never play baseball, they'll never write a poem, they'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted. And we have to recognize we are doing this to our children.
So that is Bobby Kennedy. Your response, Dr. Hotez, as an autism dad yourself as well.
Yeah, well, it's misguided on multiple levels. So let's unpack it a bit. For the first point, well, the second point where he talks about autism and not paying taxes, never working. Look, my daughter, Rachel, she's a young adult. She's in her early 30s. She can't live by herself. She lives with us. And has been living with us, but she works every day at Goodwill. She pays taxes. She earns money. She loves going to work. She walks to work. She has friends at work. She goes to the movies. And the way he portrays autism in these very dark terms simply doesn't reflect the vast majority of people who live on the autism spectrum. So I found that deeply offensive, and it has, you know, this kind of creepy tone to it as well, which we can go into more if you like. But you know, the other piece to this is you know, he also misrepresents the processes of autism. Autism occurs in early fetal brain development, and the full clinical expression often will not manifest until 1 or 2 years of age, and it can be shown that that clinical expression of autism coincides. This is work done at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, with a big increase in brain volume expansion as evidenced on imaging MRI studies. But you can actually go back months or even at the beginning of life and show that those increases in brain volume expansion are already beginning in as a consequence of the activity of autism genes. And so, again, he misrepresented, saying these kids had no issues at all, and all of a sudden there was some deus ex machina, you know, this kind of intervention that suddenly made them autistic. That's not what occurs, and we have this well documented, well detailed, and the science is quite clear. It doesn't mean that we understand every aspect of autism, but you know, that's how he needs to talk about it, saying, look, you know, through funding supported by the National Institutes of Health, we've learned an awful lot about the causes of autism, how autism genes operate, how they interact with environmental factors, how then the full clinical expression occurs between 1 and 2 years of age. And that's where he needs to go and say, okay, now we're going to bring all of the world's experts together. And we have an enormous amount of intellectual horsepower on autism here in the United States, and bring them together and say, what are the gaps? What else do we need to look at? But he, again, shows this consistent lack of intellectual curiosity, this kind of simplistic way of thinking, and talking about autism, in my view, in what almost seems to be like eugenics terms, and I found it very offensive.
Last month, switching gears a bit, Dr. Hotez, the top vaccine regulator at the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Peter Marks, resigned after being forced out by HHS Secretary Bobby Kennedy. In his resignation letter, Dr. Marks wrote, quote, "It has become clear that truth and transparency are not desired by the secretary, but rather he wishes subservient confirmation of his misinformation and lies," unquote. If you can talk more about what's happening at this point to HHS, and specifically also talk about the flu vaccine and the cancellation of the meeting that would determine the strains of flu in a new vaccine.
Well, you know, I do not have the inside baseball on what's going on at FDA or HHS. It's a bit opaque right now, more opaque than it's ever been. But you know, I will say in regard to Dr. Marks's letter, you know, that sounds about right. That Mr. Kennedy seems to have this fixed belief that vaccines do bad things to kids, and he's absolutely wrong. I mean, we have this extraordinary vaccine ecosystem. system that's led to the elimination of multiple childhood infections, including HIV meningitis and measles and many others. And now I'm really concerned that he is so fixed on these false links between vaccines and autism and other things that this is going to jeopardize our entire vaccine ecosystem. That's point one. Point two, I don't know what this means now when there's efforts to introduce new vaccines. You know, the technology now is really advancing rapidly. We have the opportunity to build next generation vaccines for emerging diseases. I'm very concerned about H5N1, and we need better vaccines for H5N1. We may have another coronavirus illness coming online. Remember, we've had SARS in 2002, which is a coronavirus, MERS in 2012, then of course COVID-19 in 2019, and I'm worried that we could have another one as well. And we always need, and the vaccine producers are always refining and improving vaccines, and I'm worried that all innovation is going to stop. On top of the fact, number three, that we're gutting the NIH, and we're facing potentially 40% cuts to the National Institutes of Health for all of our innovation. And that includes, Amy, new vaccines, not only for infectious diseases, but non-communicable diseases. For instance, we've been historically making low-cost recombinant protein vaccines, but now our scientists in the labs at Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development have really improved mRNA vaccine delivery. And now we have some exciting collaborations with our cancer center at Baylor to maybe, and we're now looking into making a mRNA vaccine for triple negative breast cancer, for which you can not use recombinant protein technology. There's some limits to that technology. So I think we're going to need mRNA for that. Is that all going to stop now with this new regime? And that also concerns me.
Dr. Peter Hotez, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas, where he's also the co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development, author of several books, including The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning, and Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. Coming up next, 25-year-old photojournalist from Gaza, Fatma Hassouna, was just killed in an Israeli airstrike. She's the subject of a new documentary that was just accepted into Cannes Film Festival, and she was deciding whether she would be able to go. The documentary called Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. We'll speak with the well-known director of that documentary, Sepideh Farsi. Stay with us.
Mama, I'm sorry I didn't believe you when you told me that you were proud of me. Yeah. But now I believe it cause I see the vision and now you're kind of funny calling me. الربط اتخرج وصحابي glad, but the real ones always right beside of me. Said I got a mission to fight for my people at home and provide for the family. I wanna get rich and I wanna get famous, but not for the reason you think. I wanna be able to cover tuitions without even having to blame. I wanna be able to go to a family in Gaza and tell them it's over. We made it, then do it again and again and again and again and again and again. Shaif Zahraj wa Sahra, Aini Aish wa Lahza. Tawul Ami Makhibani, Tabi'i Kulu Ruhi Talga. Shaif Zahraj wa Sahra, Aini Aish wa Lahza. Tawul Ami Makhibani, Tabi'i Kulu Ruhi Talga.
Desert Rose by Saint Laurent. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fatma Hassouna was a 25-year-old photographer and artist from Gaza who documented the devastating impacts on Israel's war on Gaza. She's also the subject of a new documentary called Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. On Wednesday morning, Fatma was killed, along with at least 9 members of her family, in an Israeli airstrike on her home in northern Gaza. Fatima was killed the day after the documentary was accepted at the Cannes Film Festival. This is part of the trailer of the film.
Where are you now?
This is my neighborhood.
No one lived here or here or there or there. There's no one.
When the war started on October 7th, I was traveling around the world presenting my last film that talks about a war I've personally experienced as a teenager in Iran. I decided to go to Cairo in order to cross through Rafah, but I couldn't because all the roads to Gaza were blocked. Instead, I started filming Palestinian refugees who were just arriving from Gaza. Through one of them, I came to know Fatem.
I'm a photographer.
Yes, I saw your photos. Meeting her was like a mirror held in front of me that made me realize how much both our lives are conditioned by walls and wars.
Part of the trailer of the new documentary, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. We're joined now by the film's director, Sepida Farsi, award-winning Iranian filmmaker who's speaking to us from Paris. Sepida, welcome to Democracy Now! Our deepest condolences on the death of Fatema Hassona, who you were introducing the world to even further in this new documentary. Can you tell us who she was, what she did, and how she died?
Hi, Amy. I'm so devastated. It's really hard to... I can't believe she's gone. I don't know how to talk. I met her a year ago, as you heard in the trailer. Sorry. And
take your time. I know how unbelievably, horrifyingly difficult this is. As I watched your documentary, I mean, the time you have spent with her on over Zoom, trying to talk, reconnect, the fear every single time you reached out to her that this might be the last conversation is just... That is the feeling you have throughout this documentary is, will Sepida reach her again? And what an unbelievably radiant smile, Fatema, in describing the most difficult situations that her family was in and the number of people that have died around her. That is what infuses the entire documentary.
Yes, she was exactly as you described her, Amy, a solar person, you know, radiating, very brave, resilient, young also, hopeful, sometimes in despair, but generally very strong, optimistic and very with huge integrity. Of course, throughout that year, it was a year of connections on and off and very often, as much as we could. Many times I feared for her life. Every day I wrote to her if she couldn't connect, at least we would exchange some texts and audio messages and photos, anything we could. And most of the time we would connect to talk and I would film the video calls. And yes, every day and every night I feared for her life. And somehow by the end of this period and when the selection was announced and I had started the, you know, I told her 2 days ago, just the day before she left us, she was killed, that the film was selected. She was immensely glad. I said, do you accept to come? She said, yes, on the condition that I go back to Gaza afterwards. I want to be there. The Israeli occupation wants us to leave. I do not want to leave. I will keep my land and my house like the other Palestinians. But we were trying to get her out at least for the film's presentation. And a day after I just learned the news, I can't believe it. I can't tell you how devastated I am. And we lost a great person.
can put out a statement. Is it pronounced ACID, the ACID team?
Yes.
That said about Fatma Hassouna after she was killed, her smile was as magical as her tenacity, bearing witness, photographing Gaza, distributing food despite the bombs, mourning and hunger. We heard her story, rejoiced at each of her appearances to see her alive. We feared for her, they said. So if you can tell us how she came to pick up her camera, and one of the just so poignant through this documentary is we meet one by one, even your surprise, in meeting her family members who happen to be in the space she's in wherever she manages to connect to you. We meet her brother. We meet her dad. We look at them looking at you, who is uncovered, a woman speaking to her in Paris or wherever you are. But she, all her life, has only been in Gaza.
Yes, exactly. This was a big thing for me also, and for her. I shared it with her in the sense that I had many moments of doubt, of feeling guilty, of doubting whether or not I should, exchange and share with her all of my travels and my adventures and what I was up to. And at some point, I thought that it was my way of contributing to giving her something she didn't know yet, because she never had a chance to be out of Gaza. And the first time we met, she was telling me, oh, you're from Iran. One of the cities I would love to see is Tehran. And I told her, I cannot go back to Tehran myself. And she's like, why? I said, because of political reasons. It was such an absurdity to her. She couldn't even imagine how other people than Palestinians could be locked out of their country, whereas these people are locked in their country and cannot go out. I mean, it was such a contrast between what I was living and she was living. And we put up with it, and we built the whole film and our relationship around this discrepancy of our experiences. And I think that was one of the points, that it was very rich in our exchanges, that I do not believe in God and she did, and I am in exile and she was stuck in her country. And so it was even more, moving, I think, for me, and I believe for her as well. She the first time I told her, you're so young, you're my daughter's age. And she said, oh, you could be my mother. You know, it's like, and she was so spontaneous, so generous, and so systematic in her documenting the genocide also, and in her vision of what they were going through, such a clarity, despite her young age, or because of her young age, I don't know, maybe.
We're showing her photographs, by the way, as we talk to you. I want to ask you how you met, but can you tell us how she died first this week?
I still keep asking myself the question whether there was a link between the film selection in Cannes and a day later, just a day later, her house being hit. Well, the house was hit by a bomb. People say it was targeted. I do believe that it could be the case, given the high number of the journalists and photographers in Gaza who've been killed by the Israeli army. So I think this one time, it could be one of these cases. Of course, I do not know more than that. I would love to an investigation to be done to find out, because she was so dear to me and to many of us. But the fact is that the bomb was launched on our house, and the whole house was destroyed. She and 9 other members of her family, including all those whom I knew, died. I'm trying to learn. There might be that her parents or one of the 2 parents are still alive, badly injured. I'm still looking for news. I do not know. But for sure, the number of deaths is 10 and the injuries 11. And I will never know, I think, until we do an investigation, why that house was hit.
And Sepideh, how did you meet Fatma?
As I explained in the trailer and the beginning of the film, at some point touring the world with my previous film, the animation, The Siren, I was following the news of the war, of course, on Gaza, and to begin with, October 7th, and then all that unfolded afterwards. And a piece of that puzzle was missing. Well, you see my cat, who's in the film, sorry. She's always in the image. A big piece of the puzzle was missing for me, and that was the Palestinian point of view and the Palestinian narrative. And at some point, it became so unbearable to me that I decided to go to Gaza through Rafah. So I went to Cairo to pass through, but it was already too late. Plus, I have a French passport, born in Iran. It was not possible. And so I started working with Palestinian refugees in Cairo, and through one of them, I was introduced to Fatem online, and that's how it started. Connection was immediate.
And talk about why she first picked up this camera. I mean, unbelievably dangerous. She has died with so many members of her family, but other members of her family, like her grandfather, her uncle, also died while she was alive in this last year and a half.
I think part of the Palestinian destiny or the Gazawi destiny is that they knew there's this fatality. I would refuse to accept it, but I think they had this, you know, when she says in the film, she says they cannot defeat us because we have nothing to lose. It's so enormous to hear. It takes time to take it in and to realize what she means. Now I realize what she meaning. I mean, of course you have your life to lose, but I think there's this fatality they're prepared for. So yes, she had lost 13 members of her family, if I remember correctly, in January 2024 already. She told me about them one by one. She named them and their ages and all in the film in several times. And despite that, she would not give up taking photos and documenting, and that was essential to her. Writing also, because she was also a poet, as you said, but photography, I think, was her main and most serious activity. I did ask her whether she would like to continue music, because she also sang and writing, and she said, no, photography is the most important for me. And she herself described her camera as a gun. She said, you know, like the sniper who ups the gun and shoots, I lift my camera and I shoot a photo. And it is essential to document this war and the genocide. And she kept saying that all the time. So I think it was very important to her that her photos and her work generally, texts also, would remain and be relayed and shared with larger audiences. And that's what I will be trying to do by all means.
Do you have her poem in front of you that you could read?
I can find it.
We're talking to Sepideh Farsi, the award-winning Iranian filmmaker. She's based in Paris. Her new documentary film, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk, features Fatma Hosanna, who died this week. She told Fatma the day before she died in Israeli airstrike with, it's believed, 9 members of her family, that the film had just been accepted at the Cannes Film Festival and she wanted her to be there. Did you find the film, the
yes.
poem?
Yes, this is one of her poems, The Man Who Wore His Eyes. I don't have a CV to recognize two eyes, mysterious, and I believe. I do not have a story, one clear for a stranger to believe it. And he believes. I have no physical characteristics complete to fly outside of this gravity, and I believe. Maybe I'm ushering in my death now before the person standing in front of me lifts his sharp sniper rifle, and it ends, and I'm done. Silence. Are you a fish? I did not answer when the sea asked me. I didn't know where these crows came from and pounced on my flesh. Would it have seemed logical if I said yes, let these crows pounce at the end on a fish? She crossed and I did not cross. My death crossed me and a sharp sniper bullet. I became an angel for a city, huge, bigger than my dreams, bigger than this city. I became a poetry
Sepideh,
saint.
We're ending the show. I want to thank you so much. We'll post the poem online, Sepideh Farsi, the award.
I keep drinking molten milk, trying to drive my blues away. I keep drinking molten milk, trying to drive my blues away. Baby, you're just as welcome to my loving as the flowers is in May. Molten milk, molten milk, keep rushing to my head. Molten milk, molten milk, keep rushing to my head.